Welcome to the Fifth Trooper Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Fifth Trooper Podcast. My name is Jay Shalansky. Joining me as always is my co-host, Evan Bolris.
Hey, how's it going?
And today's a very special podcast. We are actually joined by Kevin Valliere from Imperial Discipline as well. Say hello, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me back on, Jay and Evan.
Yes, sir.
No problem.
And also, we are joined by Derek Fuchs from FFG.
Hey, how's it going? Happy to be here.
And now it's time for a new segment we like to call the Interrogation Room.
It's about time we get some intel. Welcome to the Fifth Trooper's Interrogation Room.
So, Derek, for the folks at home, why don't you tell them a little bit about what you do for FFG?
Yeah, so I am the sculpting manager at Fantasy Flight Games. Essentially, I am the manager for the department that creates all of the plastic miniatures, figures, and components for our games.
So now, everyone at home, now you know why he's here. We didn't get the mail boy or anybody. We got somebody serious for you guys.
Oh, yeah, real serious.
Yeah. You know, so we've had both Alex and Luke on before, and everybody kind of knows what they do and kind of what a day in the life is for them. But, you know, Derek, what's your day look like? What's the job look like for you day to day?
Meetings, just endless, endless meetings. We're constantly working on things, right? We always have sculpts in the hopper that we're working on. And in addition to attending a lot of meetings, I'm helping, you know, guide the team and, you know, kind of discuss where we're headed with different things, give them any resources. We just kind of work on our sculpts all day and kind of have constant feedback loop that, you know, I'm involved with helping provide. It kind of begins with, you know, walking into the office and immediately being bombarded by questions on what we should be doing. Like I said, you know, we're constantly working on stuff, so we always got things going on, always new challenges. Every day we come across a new thing that we need to address or things that we want to try out, and then we kind of just put in the work and get it going.
Oh man, that's cool.
Well, and that's something like we've been trying to point out a lot, and is that like, hey, this is a regular job too for you guys. Like, as cool as this is, and as amazing as the miniatures are, and working on an IP like Star Wars, it's a job too. It's like a regular day job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's awesome, but it is definitely a job.
No, man, it's that passion thing, right? If you like what you do, you don't really work, kind of, right?
Yeah, no, entirely. I mean, I think that's what a lot of us in this industry, you know, are here for, because we enjoy games, we enjoy creating them, we enjoy playing them, and you know, it's cool when we get to work on things like Star Wars, where it's an entire world that we're you know, most of us are already fans of, and here we get to bring it further to life through various forms, like Legion.
Nice. Is this your first miniature kind of position, or where did you get your start in?
So I joined Fantasy Flight Games as a producer. Producer is essentially someone who manages a project from you know, the beginning to the end. The producer is responsible for, you know, making sure everything stays on task and on budget, relaying any information and communication that needs to be shared, and really just making sure everything goes as smoothly as possible. And the producer will interact with every department, right? With art, graphic design, the sculpting, production, the dev team. And it's kind of that centerpiece for all of that communication and knowledge on the project. And so I started as a producer, and I worked on quite a few game lines, including X-Wing, and then Legion. I was producer on Legion during the core set in the first couple of waves, and you know, through a lot of through the work on Legion and kind of the constant discussions with sculpting, you know, I ended up transitioning over to manager of the sculpting department.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, you talked about your role as managers. How many people are on your team, and what sorts of other roles do they fill?
So I have currently I have five people on my team. I have three digital sculptors, Corey DeVore, my lead, and then Adam Martin and Robert Bransig are my other digital sculptors, and they do most of our 3D organic modeling. So, you know, humans, troopers, you know, things like that. I have a plastic designer, Bexley Andrzejczyk, who does most of the hard surface models that we create, the minis. Things like almost nearly every X-Wing ship, every Armada ship, and things in Legion like the AT-RTs, the land speeders, the tanks. So he covers that. And then I have Kevin Van Sloon is my plastics design technician, and he is largely a support role for Bexley, also modeling ships and other hard surface miniatures. And then he also is, you know, the man behind the 3D printer in our office, which gets a lot of use.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was about to say the exact same thing. I saw a lot of models back there on the stream.
Yeah, we have, like I said, we run that, you know, we're doing stuff every day. We're running our printer nearly every day and just kind of iterating and getting new prints out. If you were to step into our little office department room, you would see shelves of 3D printed miniatures.
So I'm gonna pop in here with a question since we're talking about 3D printed miniatures. How has that been for you guys as far as from design to actually, you know, being able to see it in your hand, production, kind of miniature table ready? How has that, the advent of 3D printing changed how FFG approaches stuff like this, like Legion?
Oh, it's changed everything, I think. The ability to, you know, iterate rapidly, get something in your hands in a day or so and evaluate, you know, how it looked in digital form versus how you are, you know, are seeing it in your hands, and then immediately make changes based on that is incredibly important for what we do. You know,
yeah. So
back in the day,
yeah, go ahead. That's what I was going to ask you. If you could explain how it was set in the back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So back in the day, you know, it was traditionally sculpted, clay, we would send that out most of the time. We didn't have anybody on staff that could do most of the things. And so we'd send that out and they would send us their, you know, their sculpt, and it's hand sculpted. And, you know, if we had any feedback, we'd have to send it back. But most of the time you try to avoid that because it's a very long process. It's hard to communicate that feedback when it's a physical thing that you're trying to alter. And especially for things like Star Wars, which have to be very accurate. If you don't have the accuracy to, you know, the source material, you know, it's very difficult to get a hand sculpted thing in line if it's not quite there. And so, you know, you would get that and eventually you would, you know, say okay to it and send it off and it would be turned into a resin, but then you would lose that master, right? And so through the production process and you know, all you would have left are the resins, and you couldn't really make many alterations at that point. And so 3D printing has just been a tremendous tool. Most sculpting is shifting to digital, you know, organic sculpting. It's been tremendous for us.
So do you think, could you explain a little bit the difference between sort of how organic sculpting is handled versus more mechanical sculpting? And for our listeners, what I mean is more human-based or humanoid-based figures and cloth and ground and that sort of thing versus vehicles.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the biggest difference is, well, besides the software, you know, vehicles and things use a little bit more CAD-based, you know, more engineering tools because they're, you know, a lot of just geometric shapes and angles and degrees and measurements. Whereas organic sculpting is, as its name, you know, you are essentially digitally sculpting clay, and are able to kind of introduce curves and all sorts of things that, that you would take forever to do in any other more CAD-based software. And so, you know, one of the big things we use for organic, you know, ZBrush you know, it just is a tremendous tool for exactly that purpose. And
now,
you know, it just allows you to get a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Now, are you guys on, are you using Maya 3ds Max? Can you divulge that? Tips. What's all your secrets? Tell me all your secrets.
Yeah, we mainly use ZBrush. I mean, if you look through any of our job postings for the position, it'll list the, you know, the software that we're looking for experience in, and ZBrush is one of them. SolidWorks on the other end is another one that we use a lot. So,
Yeah, cool. And so, you know, for just for some listeners who may not know, so like SolidWorks, like you said, is more like if I want to design a computer or if I want to design something very mechanical that we take advantage of every day, telephone or, you know, something like that, you would use a program more like SolidWorks. But if I wanted to design like something for like an animation or a video game or something like that, a software similar to ZBrush is what we would use.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there, SolidWorks. I'm sure that given the sphere you work in, that there are plenty of demands on your job. But it's also clear that, like, even just in the way that you talk about these small sort of tasky things, you've got a lot of passion for it. So what for you is the most rewarding part of managing this process?
I really like what, you know, we do. I think that, you know, I think about this all the time, actually. And one of the most rewarding things to me is it doesn't matter what game it is. Like whenever I go into a game store or our game center, or I'm just out at different conventions and I see people down, friends, families, you know, whomever, playing games together, sitting there, you know, together, interacting, socializing, it doesn't matter what they're playing. That's what excites me. That's what's rewarding to me, because it's a shared passion, you know, across all of us gamers. And, you know, that and even more so than when it is our products and I get to see, you know, all of you playing Legion or anything else that we do. It's just, it's incredibly cool. And that's what, you know, that's what I live for.
It's good to hear.
Sure. That's awesome. That's
So
wholesome.
So content. Like you just said, and you know, most of the guys that we meet from FFG, you know, we always talk to them about gaming. So do you play Star Wars Legion?
Not as much as I would like to. I actually, over the holiday weekend, I was just home and I've been sending my dad and brother, you know, product after product. I'm like, here, you know, here's this, here's Stormtroopers, here's, you know, here's your Rebel Commandos. And he had yet to put together anything. And so I had been assembling a bunch on my own here, but I haven't actually played outside of work. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to bring all this home and do a trade. I'll give him all the assembled things. I'll take all the unassembled stuff. And and so, you know, we sat down, we actually played through a couple of games and had a lot of fun. So I haven't played as much as I'd like to, especially in my personal time, but certainly during the early development of Legion and the, you know, the alpha and beta stages, I was, you know, I was right there with Alex and we were cranking through, this is before even Luke was with us, and we were cranking through a lot of playtests and, you know, that's where I found most of my involvement.
I haven't been in wargaming too long, but I don't play as much as I want to, and I have a bunch of unassembled minis. Sounds pretty much like the wargamer's lament. So I think you're in good company there.
So I know we kind of covered it a little bit, but if you could maybe just high level walk us through the process of, from a miniature standpoint, how a new unit, you know, actually gets designed and made for you guys.
Sure. Yeah. Well, once the devs and everything is cleared on exactly what we're going to do, the release first starts with gathering as much reference as possible. A lot of that reference comes directly from Lucasfilm. We'll request it, but also a lot of it comes from screenshots of the films or the TV shows, anything that's a real source material that we can use. And it starts there and kind of studying that. And then what we'll do is we'll take that reference and generally for, say, a trooper unit, we'll start getting a T-pose in place and we'll start building all of the assets, all of the weapons and the armor and start nailing down the details. And during that time, we'll also be thinking about the poses and we'll start sketching out, where we're going to take that, what this unit's going to look like, how are they going to, try to match it to their depictions and the films or the shows or games. And we'll start mapping out what, potentially their poses will look like as we're, finalizing and wrapping up the T-pose. And then there's a lot of internal processes for feedback. We have a lot in the department. Most of my team is very collaborative. We believe in collaboration and just everyone kind of getting their hands on it and trading it back and forth if we need to. And so there's a lot of discussion that happens inside the room where, we'll throw things up on the board and or on somebody's screen and we'll kind of have a little discussion on whatever needs to be addressed. But and then we have some official, more internal with the creative directors of the studio, approvals processes, essentially, where we'll do some back and forth. And so we just continue to iterate internally until we get it into a place that, we feel very strongly about, where it's at. And then sometimes this includes discussions with Lucasfilm, depending on what it is, and the level of discussion varies. And then we'll send it off to Lucasfilm for approval and we'll get their thoughts and then another, series of iterations if needed. And then eventually, once everything's good to go, we do a little pre-production, we prepare it, send off to our production facilities which is a whole lot of work in its own right. I could talk about that for days.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure we might get to that. And eventually we start getting samples and we review the samples, make sure that there are no major flaws or errors or anything that needs to be corrected. And eventually, after a long while, it gets made and in everyone's hands.
Yeah. So, I mean, you really explained that well, but all I heard was that you guys get paid to watch Star Wars stuff, right? Is that what I
heard? Yeah, absolutely.
Basically.
It must be real. We watch Star Wars stuff anyways.
Anyways, right. It's just a bonus.
Yeah.
Derek, do you guys ever get tempted to cheat and just go look at the 501st and Rebel Legion websites for details?
I think the temptation's there, but we never do. I got a chance to talk to Brendan over Worlds Weekend, and it was the first time I really learned a little bit more about what the 501st does and how painfully, how much they pay attention to the detail and try to really accurately depict, the different pieces that they're putting together. But, for our purposes, we want to stick to the source reference and materials and do our own thing there.
Yeah. And so I think it's interesting for everybody out there to hear, besides just coming up with how the units are going to function, there's this whole other machine right behind it to like get those units for the table and get them ready. And, and like, you're even talking about like getting production ready, right? Like that's, like you said, like, yeah, we could probably talk about that all day long. Cause your first samples and then send it, cause you were talking about all the changes that you have to make just internally between FFG and Lucasfilm, but that's not even including once you go to production, like there may be things that need to be adjusted as well too, because there's something that, you know, there's a different way of packing it or a different way of putting it together that needs to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think injection molded plastic is, it's an entire process and in its own right. And in order for us to do it correctly, it means we have to pay attention to parting and, draft angles. And, we don't want to lose detail. If something's not oriented correctly, that means we have to split it into additional parts. And maybe that's too fiddly or too much for the end user to put together. And so those are all sorts of things that we kind of consider as we go through it. And even earlier before that, I didn't really hit on it, but working with Alex and Luke and what they want to do mechanically, we try at Fantasy Flight to kind of to have all the pieces of the cake that we want. And so what I mean by that is if Alex and Luke, they really want, these mechanics to happen and we want to represent that in the sculpt, we work together to figure out how to make that work. We don't, just sculpt something and then they go ahead and make it based on what we've done. We work together. We discuss the plan. We discuss what the unit's going to do and how we want to depict it. As far as the production side of things, like I said, there's a lot to consider there. And sometimes that changes the direction, as we've gotten better and have a better understanding of how to, tackle those problems a little bit more head on. We can kind of guess we can better predict what we need to do prior to actually sending it out.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And so we see less changes as a result, but it's certainly considerations there.
So over the last year or so, or maybe even more recently you've been working on them for longer than we've had them, but what we've seen in the more recent used units are these more dynamic poses. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to talk about that and where that shift came into that.
What do you like about them?
That they look like they're actually doing something on the battlefield versus just standing there.
That Pathfinder leader, I love, actually.
Oh, the one with the arm up?
As much as I love and hate Pathfinders.
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
I think even going to Jay's comment, even the standing poses have gotten so good. I'm not sure there's a model I like more for its simplicity than Krennic, because, I think Boss got this a little bit too. Krennic makes people look like way better painters than they actually are. And I'm not sure how y'all did it, but I haven't seen a bad Krennic yet. And I think that is not a testament to painters in Legion. There are plenty of great ones out there. But I think it's really a testament to the model making, because every single Krennic that I've seen looks good. That facial sculpt is great. The cape is great. Not like a leading question for you. I just felt like I needed to say that Krennic model is good.
Well, no, thank you. That's great to hear, honestly. I there's a lot of really good things in the initial waves in the core set. And for us, it was just a matter of building upon what we found was working really well. And learning from that, we got a lot of community feedback. We have a lot of internal thoughts and feedback. And then it's just a matter of looking at, our process and building upon our successes. I mean, you look at things like, the Tauntauns, for example. We don't have anything like that. And they're a really cool challenge because, as we've been focused more and more on trying to get the characteristics of these units and these characters into the sculpt form, the Tauntauns are another example of that, where, how do we capture Tauntauns in a way that isn't just, either them split open or or standing there, roaring out over the top, and just kind of paying attention to those elements. And I think, generally, as a process, for us, it's just been, we get it to a point, we get a sculpt to a point where we're like, this is good. All the details there, the accuracy is there. It feels like the character of the unit. It's been considered for, the depictions we see, and it's where we want it. And then we stop and go, how can we push this just a little bit further? And I think that's been a little bit of a mentality shift where, you know, we're trying to ask that question a little bit more often and really take our sculpts just that extra notch.
Yeah, I think y'all have absolutely achieved that. Now, I mean, looking back, is there, I guess, what was the most challenging model for you to produce with that mindset? You said tauntauns were, you know, you didn't want to just do like the sort of like funny split open or just like the standing up roaring, but you know, what model, I guess, proved a roadblock for you?
Well, I mean, you know, the tauntauns and the dewback were both challenging in the fact that, you know, they haven't been depicted that many, depicted that often. And so, you know, what we really had were the original films and a couple of the show interpretations. And you know, if you look at like the dewbacks, anyone who studies them a little closely will see that there's been a variety of depictions of them. And so kind of combining all of these elements together and figuring out what is kind of the best and working with LFL to nail down some of those questions, and really get it into a place that we were happy with was certainly challenging. Although I think more to recent developments, like with the plastic changes and just what we're doing, the B1s and the Droticas that you guys just saw on the screen, they were really our first stab at how do we take something that is this skeletal almost in nature and make it work, and not be too fiddly or too messy. And, you know, those were pretty difficult to nail down, especially because we were learning a lot and we're, you know, transitioning to the new processes. But I'm really happy with how those turned out. I mean, I think if you look at them on the table, they look awesome. The Droidicas are really cool. They, you know, alternating between the rolly form and the standing form, and the B1s have a lot of, in their arms, especially, there's a lot of posability that I think players will find they're going to be able to assemble them in some different configurations. And so, yeah, those were definitely some of the more recent challenges that have been fun to do, though.
Yeah. So while we've got you talking about the Confederacy, can you tell us a little bit about what logistical challenges led you to switching to sprues, and maybe what players who haven't used sprues in the past can expect from those models?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's important to note that, you know, the one of the biggest reasons for wanting to switch to what we call frames and kind of the harder plastic is really just wanted to get more detail. I think hard plastic, the plastic that we'll be using allows us to have a little bit more crisper edges, smaller minimums. We can get a little bit more detail out of things and not have them, like I love the Royal Guards. I think they're awesome, but I don't know if any of you open a box where you have some droopy or bendy electro staves or their shock prods, but you know, that's one of the things that the softer material does is unfortunately it bends and warps and, and this new plastic will avoid that. And so the frames are almost a necessity for switching to harder plastic because the plastic is, because it can't flex as much, it will break if you try to snap it. And so, the frames, beyond being kind of an industry standard for, you know, minis games, is also a way to protect them and to allow the end user to feel comfortable in what they get and not all have a million pieces floating in the box.
Yeah. So now right now we've got, mold lines and some of the minis that in reality haven't been particularly cumbersome to work around. Did y'all design... Maybe this is a bigger question than I'm asking. How much thought goes into design of the placement of the minis on the frames? Are y'all actively looking to try and avoid, the sprues connecting in weird places? Is that just something you kind of just have to deal with and hope that it works out? Or is that something you can control?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we're trying to be very intentional with our parting. especially I think now we have more control, but we're still learning, you know, as we do it. And I think we're trying to be very intentional with our parting and kind of see where we can hide seams along, you know, where an armor piece maybe connects at the shoulder or something that looks natural for a seam. You know, little things like that. We are, you know, as considerate as we can be with that and do what we can to not have some egregious seam, you know, going right over the top of a guy that totally obscures some detail that we want to capture. Mm-hmm.
So back in March, I think you had talked about, I think there was a tweet I saw that said that, you know, what we had seen at Adepticon with the advent of the sprues and the harder plastic was just the first steps from you transitioning over. So is the goal to completely do this for all models, or is it going to be sort of a, depending on the unit model type, you would choose that way to produce them?
No, the goal is to get everything going this way. You know, as everyone knows, or the core set, the Phase One troopers and Obi-Wan and the riders of the Bark Speeder are not, you know, hard plastic. They're the way that we've always seen them. But the B-1s and the Droidicas are on, and Grievous are on frames. And yeah, so, you know, that was just the nature of where we were at and what we could do at the time with, you know, what we knew. And now that we've been able to cross our bridge and we're transitioning everything over as much as we can.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I hadn't had as much exposure to this sprues beforehand. You know, I really liked the ease of use that especially the early Legion models had of just like slotting stuff in. Even as I was talking to my friends who were doing other war games, even that was just a huge selling point on Legion. But I am really excited to see what comes next and what y'all are going to be able to do. And I definitely think that, you know, the Clone Wars set feels like a ripe time to do that.
When you were tasked with doing the alt sculpt Vader, was that something your team was kind of excited about?
Yeah, I mean, it actually came together pretty quickly. First of all, the opportunity to kind of to take Vader on again, and you know, we knew that it was going to be in resin, and so that meant that we could get a little bit more detail and refinement into him. To that the material would allow us to kind of demonstrate or show. And, you know, we went back and forth a lot on, we knew we wanted it to be something that, that stood out, that had a little bit more going on than just Vader, in a pose. And so, the idea of some sort of basing element, really came on, and everybody was kind of excited by that. And we tried a couple of different ideas. I think at one point we had kind of him in a bit of a sandish environment with like force bending some metal construction objects around, and you know, it was a little bit too much for the purposes of the you know, what it ended up being. But it was fun to explore those options. And you know, I think one of the things that we really liked was, hopefully everyone feels this way about the base, but we thought it was a really cool idea to have a base like the rocks that are kind of breaking up and towards him, or, you know, up and away a little bit. And just trying to sell that sense of, you know, of him using the force and it's affecting the ground around him. And so that was really fun trying to, you know, figure out how we could create that, for better or worse, an illusion with the pieces. Now, I didn't know there's going to be a lot of tiny little rocks at the end, but that's what ended up working. And I think that I think it looks fantastic. I mean, I'm really happy with how the alt Vader turned out.
No, yeah, the extra basing is pretty interesting, right? As a like display piece, I think it's awesome. As a competitive piece, maybe. You know, just it's a weird like how that works for the game. But either way, man, it looks awesome though. That, yeah, it's, you know, it became quite desirable to try to get one of those.
Yeah, well, and you know, we thought it was important that regardless of the basing element there, that you know, you could assemble him with just the base, and still, you know, have your cool Celebration Vader. But he didn't need to have the rock element there if you don't want to.
Yeah, it looks cool either way, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of alt sculpts, you know, we jumped pretty quickly from current stuff to future stuff with the Clone Wars. But I think one thing we skipped over was the introduction of the multiple poses for units. You know, we've all just recently got our hands on Sabine and Bossk. There's some really gorgeous, you know, I was just looking at like a double gun version of Bossk today that I thought was really funny. can you tell us a little bit about what prompted the evolution from, you know, just sort of the single static mini to the choice and, you know, how your team has adjusted to that and what challenges it presents you?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, what our fans expect. You know, a lot of the feedback was, you know, while the minis, like you mentioned earlier in the, you know, in the first, up until this point, have been really, you know, like kind of push fit, easy to assemble. They didn't provide a whole lot of options. You had to kind of go and do a little bit of work to, if you wanted to change up or mix and match some poses or, you know, weapons or arms. And I think it's been something that's been on our mind for a while to try to accomplish and get into our different miniatures. And, you know, Bossk and Sabine are really, I think, the first examples of that to a degree. You know, and also where it makes sense, right, with the Sabine and Bossk, you know, I mentioned how we talk with the devs about what kind of mechanics and things they want to do. Well, they knew they wanted to have Sabine with a darksaber, and we wanted to depict that some way. And so, you know, providing an alternate arm as an option was a great way to help do that. And, you know, when you talk about, well, Sabine, you know, she's such a character in the show, and she has a very distinct look both with the helmet and without. And how could we not include both of those as well? And just provide those options and really. You know, everyone was really happy with that internally. And I think, you know, we're starting to see the results of that. It's been amazing looking at everyone's painted Sabines and Bossks and seeing the different, you know, configurations that they go with. And it's interesting to see who chooses what. But they look great. And so we wanted to continue applying that to, you know, as much of the future stuff as possible and just provide our players with this is, you know, more customizability wherever we can.
Yeah. Now I do want to follow the posability thread a little bit further in a minute, but before I do that, one thing, I'm not sure if it was intentional, if this is something that y'all think about when sculpting minis, but as I've been looking at the Bossk and Sabine release together and, you know, looking, having my hands on both now, it feels like Bossk lends itself, I think Bossk is sort of a little bit easier overall to paint, but allows for still a great range of detail. Sabine is, in much the same way that I love Boba Fett, almost a blank canvas. You know, I wrote an article about all the different like patterns and aesthetics that go into Sabine's armor. Mm-hmm. Do y'all, yeah, and I think like, you know, there's sort of a threshold for like, you can just paint it black and it's probably going to look great anyways, or you could go for that checkerboard pattern and really try and sell this authentic Sabine look. What sort of consideration do y'all to give to painter skill level when you're making minis? Like, are there some techniques or some design methods that are off limits to you just because you want to make sure that it is an accessible mini?
I think that, the character or the unit or whatever we're depicting comes first. And so making sure that all of the pieces that are supposed to be there are there, you know, the jacket and the helmet and, you know, whatever we're trying to capture is, you know, accurate and to the source material and reads at, you know, from a table distance, as what, you know, we're trying to depict. And so I think that comes first and honestly supersedes or over, you know, overwrites any other considerations. Especially when it comes to painting. Now, I think when I think about what looks and works really well on a mini like Bossk, right? He's got great, he's got these great like areas of large folds, you know, with his jumpsuit. Mm-hmm. And but then he's got this detailed scaling that really captures a lot of the, you know, the paint and the washes. And so, you know, it's important that in those areas we make sure that we push them so that paint does catch. And we know that we're like, well, if you prime this and throw a couple layers on, we don't want that detail getting covered up or feeling like it's now smooth. And so, you know, we'll go in and push it further and further until, you know, we're happy with it and know that, you know, it's going to look great in the end once it's all painted up. And I think, you know, like I said, Bosk is, you know, he's been a poster child lately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the same way that I was talking about how, I don't think I've seen a single bad Chronic Mini. I feel very similarly about Bosk, where those scales catch highlights and shadows mm-hmm. so well that it really elevates people's painting. I think that's, you also absolutely be commended for how you did that, because I can't imagine that finding that balance was easy. But I did say I wanted to follow that posability thread, and we did get to finally see on the stream, both with the Fifth Trooper over the weekend and today on the live stream, the very, very cool swinging sidecar on the Bark Speeder. So not only do we have like the separate static poses, we've got multiple poses in game. How cool is that for design?
Oh, you know, it's something you see in the show and that they do. And we're like, well, we have to, right? We're not going to just lock this in. And so, I mean, it has a mechanical tie-in, right? And I think that's important. Anything we do should have a mechanical tie-in. And so for it to be able to swing around, but that whole sidecar is optional too, right? You don't have to take it. You don't have to assemble it with the sidecar. You can do just a single bike without them. And you know, that's also an option just in that, you know, the, I don't know how much of was spoiled for the Bark, but you know, there's also a couple of upgrade options that are then represented by sculpt pieces for the sidecar in particular, and you know, some additional options there. And then I don't know if you all saw the Phase 1 clones in a little bit more detail, but one of the things that we did with those in the core set was really tried to get cylindrical plugs for all of those things. So you know how traditionally there's been kind of specific fits to a lot of the, you know, the arm or head connections. And one of the things we knew as we continued to talk about, well, how can we provide more posability or options, was to create cylindrical plugs that allow for a little bit of rotation in the arms, you know, up or down, or the head left mm-hmm. or right. And because they're pretty much the same size, you can actually swap those arms out with minimal effort and put, you know, a long rifle on somebody that, you know, didn't have that before. And, you know, it, just that little bit of motion where you can turn that head left or right and raise that arm up, down, you know, up or down, like he's, you know, a trooper's looking down the sights or kind of more at the ready, I think is going to really be, it's going to look great. I think people are going to really love that and be able to kind of mix and match and customize. And I think we're going to see a lot of clone Phase 1 troopers that are not like other people's. Like people will assemble them in different ways, and that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, I think that's super exciting for the community too, right? Is that because right now we're relegated to painting to make ourselves unique. And so be able to also add on to that a little bit of posing as well, that's going to be, I think that's going to be huge for us as mm-hmm. Hobby enthusiasts. So that is very cool. But all right. Well, Derek, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having
me. Yeah. And you guys have been,
thanks for coming on.
Yeah. You guys have been doing a wonderful job. So thank you so much for kicking butt on these models.
Thank you. Yeah, hopefully I can be back on here in the future.
Oh, heck yeah.
Talk about new stuff.
Yeah, so that was Derek Fuchs from FFG. I don't know. I thought that was an extremely interesting conversation. I don't know what you guys thought.
Yeah, it's interesting to see what they're thinking about and what's coming down the pike, because yeah, I mean, like, it's that selling point of just like the So Easy minis and the moving to the sprues. You know, I know that some people had concerns about that, but I think it's going to lead to some really cool stuff.
It's just one of those avenues when you're in a miniature war game that you don't really think about. Like most of the time we're thinking about what announcement Luke or Alex is going to say, because they actually affect the gameplay. Right. But you don't always think about the guys who are actually, you know, going crunch time, trying to make the Death Troopers look like Death Troopers before they get sent out for the release date, you know?
Yeah. And I'm going to be honest a little bit. I'm a little worried about the going to the sprues or the racks there. I think it's going to be good from a hobby aspect. So this is the hobbyist in me, like the old school. I think it's great. But I think that you may suffer a little bit with, I mean, Kevin, you know, you were newer to the hobby when you picked up Star Wars Legion. If they were all on racks, like, how would you have dealt with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I remember as a kid trying to put together, God, I don't even know what the name is. There's some Warhammer army that looks like Zerg from StarCraft. And I tried to put those...
Tyranids.
Yes, Tyranids. I tried to put those things together and it stopped after one because I had glue all over my fingers. So that's what I think of, or at least what I used to think of when I think of sprues. Now I've done a couple of the Lord of the Rings minis. They have sprues. I do the Gundam models. They're on sprues. I'm a lot more comfortable with what that entails now, and I have the tools to do it. I feel reasonably confident that they're going to do it in such a way that it is still accessible, but I don't know. I think maybe it's just part of an inevitable growth of the game. Like, if we want to see Legion get better and do more things, we're going to have to lose some of that accessibility, you know?
I don't disagree at all. And I think it'll probably be up to us, you know, like, for instance, telling people for the droids, don't use super glue, use plastic glue.
Yeah.
It's going to be easier for you. So it'll be up to guys like us to just make sure some of the newer people to the hobby aspect, you know how to work this stuff. So
look out for that Imperial Discipline.blog article, what sprue means for you, coming to your computer early August.
This stuff writes itself.
And I'm going to be honest with all of you out there. You shouldn't wait till August to go to Kevin's website. You should go now. It's amazing, especially if you're newer to the hobby and stuff. Even if you're old to the hobby, screw it. You should go to Kevin's blog and you should give him tons of hits because he deserves it and he does amazing work. So
thanks man, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. So I thought it'd be fun, we got a few minutes here, to do like a little debrief of the Northeast Open. So
yeah, man,
we had our big tournament this past weekend, Saturday and Sunday. If you didn't catch it, we live streamed both days on our YouTube channel, and you know, I thought it'd be fun for Kev here to tell us how it was from a player aspect, because Kevin came up and played in the tournament. So what'd you think, man?
I mean, listen, this is going to sound like I'm just blowing smoke up your ass because I'm on your podcast, but like genuinely, it was an amazing experience. And I don't think there's anyone who went that would say anything other than the fact that it was just so good all around. From, you know, the level of terrain was exceptional. I mean, like the Cook family boards stand out as some that were really amazing. That Hoff one that ended up on the stream day two was incredible. I don't think it ended up on stream at all, but maybe you all saw pictures of the piece of or the terrain table that was done with kids' toys. I absolutely loved that idea.
That was our boy Evan's idea.
Oh, that was you, Evan? I don't think I realized that.
Yeah, that was mine. That was my contribution to my only contribution really to the table.
That was literally the first table that I took a photo of when I got there. I saw that and I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. So sending it to my girlfriend and sending it to the Discord. Yeah, I mean, I think like from the quality of the competition, just to the friendliness of everyone there, it was a great event. I think Salt City Comic Con was fun too. It was sort of the perfect level of event to be surrounding. It was also so nice to have as much space as we did. Who knows if that's going to be a thing you can finagle next year.
So actually, funny thing is, I you know, we did our debrief with the guy who runs Salt City, and we're good for next year for the same amount of space. Yeah,
I mean, I used to play in like New York City, or even like Magic the Gathering and KeyForge. Like, you are just butt to butt with everyone around you. So yeah, that is a real, real nice change of pace. in terms of space available to me.
They put the tables end to end too, right? So like, if you wanted to pop over to the other side. Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, tables, competition, the prize support that y'all gave out. I can't say enough good things about it. And I hope y'all feel good about it, because certainly I had a fantastic time, and it's not even a question that if I am remotely free, I'll be there next year.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and press pay now on this PayPal account. So what did this was your first kind of major tournament too, right, Kevin?
For any game at any point, yeah. I mean, we do small stuff around here in New York City. I really like the guys that we play with, but it's small, you know, just out of necessity in New York City. So for any sort of board or war game, yeah, this is my first one.
So if you could kind of talk to like your mindset going in, because I think there's a lot of people that, especially that listen to this podcast, that have never been to a tournament, and maybe they have a little trepidation or a little, you know, something holding them back from going. So maybe kind of, if you want to talk through maybe your emotional experience a little bit from before, like thinking about going, to then attending and seeing the great community and everything.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's not a big secret that I'm a pretty anxious person, and especially when it comes to big competitive things that gives me the heebie-jeebies. But I think there are just certain types of events that understand the nature of a competitive game like this, and you can either play into that or you do what you can to sort of have a quality event while also ameliorating that. And I feel like you guys were the latter. I was, even knowing that, you know, I'm in the benefit of a lot of the people at Northeast Open. I've talked to a ton on Discord. I knew you guys. I knew Brendan and Kyle and all these other guys who are awesome and were there. But even then, you know, I was still feeling pretty nervous. Wasn't really talking to anybody when I first got there. But at a certain point, I don't know. I think one of my favorite things about Legion is that it is a Star Wars property. And like, no matter what's going on, you've got this one thing in common with pretty much everyone there, where you can just talk shop about Star Wars all day, even if you're not a great painter or you're not a great player. And certainly I'm not a great player. It is a great bonding experience, and I'm definitely an introvert. And so normally I find myself after stuff like that wanting to just crawl into a hole and not talk to anybody for forever. But like, it wasn't even a question after day one. I was like, yes, I absolutely want to go out to dinner and hang out with these people and have a couple drinks. It was great. And I had zero regrets about going out too. And I was all the more excited to return the next day and hang out. I think y'all hit a really great divide between, there was some really high level of competition, and congrats again to Sploosh and to runner-up Bush Vex, who, you know, I got to do table reporting for that championship game, and it was a blast to watch that final game. There was some really high level competition, but at no point did I feel the pressure of I have to perform really well here or anything like that. It was just a great time all around. I love too, y'all did the Jankiest Award. The guy who won the Jankiest Award was my very first competition, Christian. I don't know if you listen to this podcast. He had 3 core and 5 vehicles, 3 ATRTs, an airspeeder, and a landspeeder, and he went up against my 10 activation impact heavy imperialist, and I felt bad for him because like that's the worst matchup he could have drawn. But he had such a good time, and I'm so glad that he won the Jank Award. So
dude, I love that guy. He was so like excited about bringing Jank, and he was like, oh, I hope, like before we did our voting and everything, he's like, I hope I win. I brought 5 vehicles. And in my head, I'm just like, yeah, you won. What I mean? But he had a great time. He was telling me afterwards. And so that was exciting to see that. But I guess, you know, I didn't bring it up because I wanted you to like tell everybody how great of a job we did. The reason I was bringing it up is because I think from a community standpoint in general, we have an opportunity to, I wanted to prove that we could do both, like what you said, where we could have a nice casual event for, you know, you weren't the only first person for a tournament. There was a number of players there that this was their first tournament. Some of them, it was only like their fourth game ever. And so I think there's an opportunity where we can still be uber competitive. I mean, we had two Worlds attendees there, plus, you know, plus some of the best people on Discord on the TTS. And so there's an opportunity where you can have both. That they, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can do both at the same time. And this was kind of my like test bed, you know, to see if that was possible.
Mm-hmm. All right, Evan, you were on stream pretty much the whole time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was managing the stream.
What did you enjoy most about your time at the Northeast Open?
Oh gosh.
Besides getting to sleep afterwards.
Yeah. you know, it was just cool to see a lot of my friends. Getting to see them in one place where it was in the East. And normally when I have to go to Elysian events, like, right, like Jay knows, we got to travel at least 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Like, one way. So it was cool to have everyone in the area, hanging out, having a good time. The awards were fun. You know, it was overall, man, like it was a great fan event. Like that's kind of why, kind of what we did it for, right? Like it was casual, it was competitive. Those two can go hand in hand, and everyone left and no one looked upset. You know, that's not normally a tournament, right? So it was cool to see everyone like leave happy for a change.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for anybody out there listening that wants to organize a tournament, I think the part of it is it's got to be, you can't just make it about the competition. You got to make it about, like, it's like part of the show. Like, and as for an example, like we had the Mandalorian, I forgot their name, the Mandalorian.
Oh, the Mando Mercs?
Yeah. They came over. We had a bounty on Luke Cook since he was the world champion. Kyle had put a bounty on him for a core set that Doug Krop, a.k.a. Sploosh, ended up picking up. And so we had the Mandalorians come over and claim the bounty on Luke and take him away in handcuffs. And so, you know, I think that kind of sets tone for everybody, the new guys, to know that, okay, it is a tournament and there is a winner. But at the same time, I'm going to have fun while I'm here. Because how many events are, you know, I know, Kevin, this was kind of your first one. But most of the events that, like, Evan and I have been to, it's just, like, exhausting. Like, and you want to go have fun after you've done the tournament, but you're just kind of, like, done. And you're like, I just want to go to bed, man. You know, and so I think there's an opportunity there for the community as a whole, because it is a longer game, to work out a way where it can be exhilarating and fun. And also you get to hang out and spend time with people and compete.
Yeah.
All at the same time.
Yeah.
So.
Y'all did a great job.
Well, thanks, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I do appreciate it. That's cool. Thank you.
Okay, this is a side note. I'm going to cut this. Kevin, are you comfortable with me announcing that like once a month you're going to do something, or do we not want to set expectations?
Do it. Follow me.
Okay. So back in 3, 2, 1. So that's going to wrap it up for us today. But what I want to say really quick is, for those of you that read Kevin's blog, for those of you that don't, you should be. Dummy, go read it right now. And for those of you that do already and already love Kevin, we have a really cool little announcement here. Once a month, Kevin's going to join us for a select amount of time and kind of do a special little piece for us once a month on the podcast. And it'll be maybe something he's working on his blog, or something that he's just thinking about, or something that he wants to help players with. But he's going to come on and have a little segment on our podcast.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Definitely. There's like 1,000 things I have that don't quite make a full blog post, but that I think I can flesh out to make some good audio content. So I'm honored to be joining the family and pitch in every so often.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. Yeah. So, all right. Well, that's our little...
I hope you're ready for dramatic Star Wars fan fiction, because that's what it's going to be.
Perfect.
That's Evan.
Right, that's what we agreed to, right?
Evan's already doing it. Evan's new segment is he's writing. We're gonna have audio plays, so it's gonna be amazing.
So I missed the boat, damn.
Yeah, we're gonna be the most unique and random podcast that's ever been.
I love it.
So. But all right, Kevin, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, thank you guys. I always love coming on.
And everyone out there in podcast land, thanks for joining us.
Everyone, stay rad.
Join us next week for another edition of the Fifth Trooper Podcast.
This has been a Fifth Trooper production.